Coming up, as Election Day approaches, Kim Lawton talks to faith leaders about the guidance religious traditions have for morally conflicted voters. And Dan Lothian on the special concerns of Muslim American voters. Also, spirituals, the powerful music created by slaves.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us this Election Day week. We'll continue our special election coverage in a few minutes, but first, the other news. In a dramatic gesture many would never have anticipated, Pope Francis traveled to Sweden this week to help launch commemorations of the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation. Francis and leaders of the Lutheran World Federation pledged to improve relations and work toward healing centuries of conflict and sometimes violent schism. They agreed to partner on issues including helping refugees and caring for the planet. The Protestant Reformation began in 1517 after Martin Luther, then a Catholic priest, publicly condemned some Catholic Church practices. Francis praised Luther for highlighting the centrality of Scripture. The Pope also raised eyebrows on his return trip. During a news conference on the plane, Francis was asked whether the Church's ban on female priests would ever be changed. The Pope responded by citing Pope John Paul II, who said the ban was an infallible part of Church teaching. When the reporter pressed Francis about whether that meant forever, he responded, quote, "It is going in that direction." Italy was struck by another powerful earthquake last week. It was the third major earthquake to hit the country in the last 2 months and the strongest in 36 years. Although no deaths were reported, the quake destroyed several churches, including the ancient Basilica of St. Benedict in Norcia. The basilica was built over the site where the founder of the Benedictine order was born in 480. Cultural authorities estimate 5,000 historic buildings have been damaged by the series of earthquakes that have shaken central Italy. The quakes have also left many homeless. Iraqi Christians celebrated the first Mass in 2 years in Karakash last week. The ancient Christian town in northern Iraq fell to ISIS in 2014, but was liberated as part of an ongoing effort to retake Mosul. The Syrian Catholic Archbishop of Mosul led the Mass at the Church of the Immaculate Conception. Meanwhile, humanitarian agencies are attempting to help the thousands displaced by the operation surrounding Mosul. French authorities have demolished a migrant camp in the northern port of Calais, and the last of those who have lived there have now left. The camp once housed up to 10,000 migrants, mainly Afghans, Eritreans, and Sudanese. Many of those who had remained were unaccompanied minors. France is hoping Britain will take in most of them. Britain has already welcomed about 300 children. Earlier in the week, migrants at the camp attended the final service at a small makeshift church. France's government has been under pressure to move the children and avoid the reemergence of a shantytown. Here at home in North Dakota, protests over a proposed pipeline continue. Last week, tensions between protesters and law enforcement officials erupted. Protesters set fire to several vehicles and signs. Approximately 150 were arrested after officers used pepper spray to disperse the crowds. This week, a broad coalition of clergy stood with protesters and environmentalists who say the $3.7 billion pipeline threatens the region's water supply and Native American sacred sites. Now our election coverage continues with a Kim Lawton special report. As voters head to the polls, there is strong support for each candidate, but many voters are also expressing deep negative feelings about the race overall, and some are conflicted about how or even whether they should vote. What guidance do various spiritual traditions have to offer morally conflicted voters?
The presidential election, I probably wouldn't choose anybody.
I think it's pretty exhausting. I don't really like either one of the candidates.
And if we allow these things to divide us, we are in trouble.
It's a little bit like a wreck. It's fascinating. It's a wreck, and you cannot take your eyes off it. But it's not inspiring, that's for sure.
Neither of these people represent me and what I stand for, and so I don't want to do this because I feel like both of them are going to bring about negative changes in the democracy.
As voters go to the polls this year, in many quarters, the mood is decidedly downbeat.
Voters overwhelmingly tell us that they're having a negative reaction to the campaign.
Greg Smith is Associate Director of Research at the Pew Research Center, which has been polling voters throughout the pre-election season.
Many of them say that they're disgusted by it, that they're disappointed. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're not engaged. In fact, many of them are engaged. But by and large, people tell us that they are very unhappy with the state of this campaign.
We know in our Smith says the high levels of negativity can be seen in the nature of the support for the candidates.
On both sides, we're seeing people tell us that the support for their candidate is driven as much by opposition to the other side. That's not just true of Trump supporters, many of whom say that they are supporting Trump primarily as a matter of opposing Clinton. The same thing is true on the other side. There are many Clinton supporters who say that they're supporting Clinton for president mainly as a matter of opposing Trump.
The negativity among voters often takes on a moral dimension. Many people of faith are among those raising concerns about the rhetoric that has dominated the campaign.
We have fissures that have formed among the people that are being widened by this rhetoric and that are tearing us apart as a beloved community that we had tried to work for from the time of Dr. King.
We should be talking about what we can do to make this a more moral world, about what we can achieve for our fellow human beings. And, you know, instead it's become ugly, vitriolic mudslinging, and then it just, you know, breaks my heart as somebody who loves this republic.
Some voters question whether they can in good conscience vote for either candidate. Chad Pecknold is professor of systematic theology at Catholic University of America. A pro-life Catholic, Pecknold tends to be politically conservative. This year, he says, he's very conflicted.
Donald Trump is such an abnormal candidate, such a candidate of evident viciousness. That hasn't inclined me to vote for Hillary Clinton because of her position on abortion.
So where does that leave you for November 8th?
It leaves me not voting for Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. I don't know where it leaves me in terms of whether or not I leave the top slot blank. It leaves me thinking that all my down ticket choices have to be about advancing the common good and resisting the evils that I think can come from a corrupt executive.
Some voters are planning on voting for a third party candidate. Others may write in another option. Many say they feel forced to vote for the lesser of two evils. Reverend Carolyn Davis, Deputy Director of the Center for Public Theology at Wesley Theological Seminary, says from a Christian perspective, all candidates fall short.
When we vote, we always vote for a less than perfect option.
Certainly one is free to say, look, there are no good choices here in this particular race. We think about voting as not the lesser of two evils, but who advances the good the best and does the least harm.
Steve Schneck of Catholic University says Pope Francis has urged people to vote their consciences through a citizenship of prudence.
We need to carefully think and sift and make our choices, not expecting that we're going to, you know, solve once and for ever the problem of sin in the world, but make what progress we can in what incremental ways are available to us.
Rabbi Moline, who's president of Interfaith Alliance, agrees that even if people are unhappy with their choices, they have a moral obligation to vote their values.
When you walk into the voting booth, I have compared it to the Holy of Holies in the ancient temple. A curtain is closed behind you. You are alone with your God and your vote. People will cast their votes listening to their hearts. When they come out of the voting booth, they have to return to listening to each other.
Voting is the way we begin to fulfill our social obligation to one another, to hold one another in care. And that's something that is common to many of our religious traditions, I would argue all.
So I encourage you to please go and vote. Vote your conscience, vote your perspective, but vote.
Indeed, many faith traditions are encouraging their members to vote. In several areas, churches have been sponsoring Souls to the Polls projects, where congregants are bused to polling places after services for early voting.
Make sure that whatever you need in life is covered by the person that you are voting for.
Davis says it's good to remember that voting is not just a privilege, but a hard-fought-for right.
Not too long ago, African Americans from across the South got together and marched across a bridge, facing beatings, dogs, hoses, because there was something critical about being able to go to the polls to vote for leaders that represented them.
Many religious groups are also urging a time of prayer for the nation prior to the election. In Washington, several spiritual traditions held a Chant for Change gathering.
You know, the political leaders ultimately are only a reflection of the people. And with the amount of tension and nastiness that's going on, I think if the American people didn't like it, then that would stop. So I think this group, you know, they're all saying that, hey, let's change the tenor of the conversation here, and it needs to start with us.
Beyond the election, Moline says the faith community will also have an obligation to help the nation to heal.
There have certainly been enough religious communities that have promoted the divisive issues in this campaign. Now it's time to think about what our responsibilities to our real values and our real faith are.
To do justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with God.
Chief among those responsibilities, he says, will be rebuilding relationships and rebuilding trust. Trust in one another and trust in our system of government.
There's an old Hasidic saying that people like to sing. The world is a narrow bridge, but the important thing is not to be afraid. I think we all know that we're on tenuous ground wherever we are in this world with all of the issues that face us. And there are lots of things to be afraid of. But the essence is not to be afraid, to walk with other people across that narrow bridge to get to the other side, whatever the promise is of what's on the other side.
I'm Kim Lawton in Washington.
One of the many voting blocs courted this year has been the country's growing number of Muslims. Correspondent Dan Lothian reports from Florida that one of the most important concerns of Muslim American voters is what they see as growing Islamophobia.
This hardly feels like a political battleground. The only rhetoric at the South Florida beach is the sound of wind and a few muffled words from surfers as they paddle and position themselves to catch the next wave. But in the land of sunshine and palm trees, there's a final big push underway to mobilize people in key voting blocks, and Muslim Americans are increasingly becoming attractive, if not influential.
The union knows that this is a community that we need to reach out to educate, empower them, to get more politically relevant in the process.
And one of the people helping to do that is Nazda Alam, a longtime political organizer in her home state of Massachusetts. She's been down in Florida for weeks, volunteering with union members and other groups to get Muslim Americans to register and vote in the upcoming presidential election.
In 2008 and 2012, we also, I personally were very involved with the Muslim voter registration and Muslim reach out. And that time, my focus was civic engagement. And we asked the Muslims that if you live in this country, you are the part of this land, part of the fabric of that, that you do your civic duty. But this year is also an issue with our existence, our safety, and our religious identity.
That message is being heard in religious institutions like this mosque in Boca Raton. For Muslims, especially recent immigrants, sitting on the sidelines is no longer acceptable.
They have in their backgrounds in the mind that I need to get established before I can help anyone else. And when they receive any oppositions or any discriminations, we were all under the idea of it's okay, keep silent about it, don't raise an issue, because you need to keep moving. But it has reached a point where Islamophobia itself, the damage that they are causing to the Muslim communities, is way beyond silence.
There are an estimated 170,000 Muslim Americans in Florida. According to the Pew Research Center, the population is about 3.5 million in the U.S. This time around, they lean Democrat, but it wasn't always that way.
This is the biggest and quickest shift in voting behavior that I can think of in American political history.
Robert Watson is a professor of American Studies at Lynn University in Boca Raton and the author of about 40 books on politics and government. He points to the year 2000. Republican George W. Bush's faith and values message got him more than 70% of the Muslim vote in Florida, where he narrowly won the presidency. 8 years later, those numbers flipped in favor of President Obama, the Democrat.
There's basically two touchstone events that are changing the landscape of Muslim American political behavior. The first one was George W. Bush's response to 9/11. The second big event would be Donald Trump's candidacy.
As volunteers went door to door and worked the phones to encourage Muslims to register and vote, conversations kept coming back to Islamophobia.
Right now, given the current climate and the political rhetoric, we're targeted, so we're being attacked.
A recent poll by the Council on American-Islamic Relations found that 85% of those who responded believe Islamophobia and an anti-Muslim sentiment increased in the past year. At times, this issue has been front and center in the presidential campaign, with Hillary Clinton, according to polls, getting the majority of support among this fast-growing constituency. Both of the candidates have been spending a lot of time here in Florida, and Hillary Clinton, who was just at a rally here, has been focusing specifically on Muslim Americans. In fact, she has a point person that's doing outreach to the community. Now, while Muslim Americans still care a lot about faith and values, the younger generation, the millennials, are also putting a lot of weight on the economy and who will help keep them safe.
I think the youth is trying to create their own narrative.
Thank you.
That's what that is. The youth wants what you see on television and what is commonly portrayed for American Muslims across the country is not the real face and voice of American Muslims.
Emerge, a national organization working to educate and engage more Muslims in the political process, is taking advantage of that.
We want to definitely pinpoint where these strong leaders are in the community and then give them all the support that they need to be able to represent our community.
Before you are left with the impression that this entire voting bloc has abandoned its right-leaning roots, meet Saba Ahmed, a lawyer, founder of the Republican Muslim Coalition, and Trump supporter.
Muslims believe in conservative values. We're very much pro-life, pro-traditional family values, traditional marriage, pro-business, less taxes, pro-trade. A lot of things that our community generally cares about align with the Republican Party.
And what about the rhetoric in this campaign? Like the Muslim ban, a position Trump held, then backed away from.
I tend to ignore it. And then Donald Trump himself toned down on his anti-Muslim rhetoric quite a bit. I tend to see it as an opportunity for Muslims to engage with the Republican Party and to educate them about Islam and Muslims. There's hardly any Muslims within the Republican Party to counter the narrative. And that's what we're trying to do.
Ahmed says her political views aren't always welcomed in certain mosques and that it's challenging trying to defend some of the comments from politicians in her party. But she's working within, not walking away.
Presidential candidates ought to be reaching out to all communities and regardless of our faith, reach out to voters in swing states and especially to Muslim Americans because we feel so vulnerable and isolated.
Very good. You're doing your civic duties.
Yeah, I'm trying.
Alam, who continues working the phones and knocking on doors, thinks the Democratic Party and Hillary Clinton, not Trump, are the better option. But they all agree on this.
I wanted to see peace and harmony with all community together. Everybody's voice is important. We need to make a peaceful world, not killing, but loving.
For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Dan Lothian in Boynton Beach, Florida.
Washington National Cathedral, Howard University, and Wesley Theological Seminary recently hosted a concert that featured spirituals, the great Christian music of African slaves in the U.S. We talked with Reverend Kelly Brown Douglas, the cathedral's canon theologian, about the history of spirituals and their relevance today.
This is a very special evening of music, the music of the African diaspora, testifying to the struggles and strivings of African peoples. Spirituals are, of course, the songs that the enslaved crafted to tell the story of their experience, but more than that, to tell the story of their faith and the understanding of who they were in relationship to God and who God was in relationship to them, and it became a story of freedom. Oftentimes when we tell the story of slavery, we talk about the way a people were acted upon, but we don't often tell the story of slavery from their own perspective. They resisted and they acted back, and the fact of the spirituals is a testament to the way in which they acted back and to the way in which they crafted their own culture. We talk about their testimony of faith is that indeed they were testifying to a God that they knew in freedom and a God that knew them in freedom. I often like to say, even though the enslavers introduced them to Christianity, they did not introduce them to God. The enslaved Africans knew God before their enslaving kidnappers kidnapped them. They are also songs that function on a more practical level because within those songs are coded messages. And so they are able to talk to one another in an honest way about their hopes, their dreams, to relay other kind of messages that they can say in open, yet hidden from view of their enslavers. So for instance, go down Moses, way down in Egypt's land, tell O Pharaoh to let my people go. They may be talking about when they're getting ready to escape the Underground Railroad, or even speaking about some of the slave rebellions that we know about. They talk about God's going to trouble the water, wading in the water. Immediately images crossing over into freedom, crossing over into free land. And so we know that, yeah, perhaps they're even really talking about and giving someone a message and a signal. It's time to go wading in the water. It's time to get out of here. It's time to become free. Going under and rising up again to a new life. As long as African Americans must continue to struggle for their rights as human beings in this country and in this context, as long as we still live out of a legacy of slavery, then the spirituals will continue to have residence.
On our calendar, members of the Baha'i faith will celebrate the birth of their founder, Baha'u'llah, who was born on November 12, 1817. And Sikhs celebrate the birthday of Guru Nanak Dev Sahib, the founder of their religion. Finally, in Jerusalem's Old City, for the first time in centuries, researchers got a look inside the tomb that many Christians believe was the burial place of Jesus. Renovations have been taking place at the ancient Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and this past week, workers cleared layers of marble and stone to find a limestone burial bed that they believe had been cut into a cave. There was no indication of who, if anyone, had been buried there, but it did match descriptions in the Bible story. That's our program for now. Congratulations, Cubs. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's also much more on our website where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org/religionethics. As we leave you, scenes from All Souls Day this past week when Pope Francis held a mass at a cemetery in Rome.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.